Case of the day, Ryan versus United States, 10-2564. The appellant, Michael Paisner. Am I pronouncing that correct?
May it please the court, Michael Paisner on behalf of the petitioner appellant Trevor K. Ryan. In the order under review, the district court dismissed Mr. Ryan's Section 2255 motion as untimely. This court should reverse that order and remand this case to the district court. I would like to make three main points in support of that outcome. First, the district court utterly disregarded Mr. Ryan's properly raised statutory claims for the timeliness of his motion. Second, those claims have merit. Third, Mr. Ryan has a decent chance of success on at least one of his substantive claims. His Sixth Amendment claim of ineffective assistance based on his counsel's failure to file a notice of appeal on his behalf, the subject of this court's certificate of appealability. The parties do not even dispute the first point. The government acknowledges that the district court disregarded Mr. Ryan's adequately raised timeliness claims under Section 2255 F2 and F4, instead treating his motion as if it only sought equitable tolling of the statute of limitations. This court's precedents, in particular Montenegro v. United States, made clear that this approach was incorrect. Based on this undisputed error alone, Mr. Ryan is at the very least entitled to a remand to the district court so that it can address his delayed accrual claims for the first time. That is the approach the 11th Circuit has taken in similar circumstances, and this court could choose to follow it here. Such a remand might entail allowing the district court to determine in the first instance whether Mr. Ryan is entitled to an evidentiary hearing on his claims. Mr. Ryan is entitled to more significant relief, however, because turning to his second point, his timeliness claims have merit. Section 2255 motions are subject to a one-year statute of limitations. Although there is some uncertainty in the record, all the parties agree that Mr. Ryan filed his motion sometime between May 26, 2010 and June 1, 2010, about 14 months after his conviction became final on March 26, 2009. The facts in the record, combined with Mr. Ryan's sworn statements, are more than sufficient to support the delayed accrual of his substantive claims by the mere 2 months necessary to make them timely. I will first address Mr. Ryan's due diligence argument under Section 2255 F4. For two reasons, the undisputed record evidence alone establishes that a duly diligent person in Mr. Ryan's circumstances would not have discovered that no appeal had been filed until at least 2 months after his conviction became final. First, the district court stated at the sentencing hearing that it was committing Mr. Ryan to federal custody. In evaluating due diligence claims, this court has repeatedly recognized the importance of taking into account that prisoners are limited by their physical confinement. Second, the transcript of the sentencing hearing establishes that the district court did not inform Mr. Ryan of the 10-day deadline for appealing. As the Fifth Circuit recognized in United States v. Gibson, and as this court implicitly acknowledged in Tress v. United States, time limitations can be a crucial element in a defendant's right of appeal. A defendant who is not aware of such a deadline will also not be aware of the need to follow up with his attorney after the deadline passes. Mr. Ryan's sworn statements in his Section 2255 motion and memorandum further support his due diligence claim. He swears that he asked his trial counsel at the time of sentencing to appeal his sentence, was under the impression that this was being done, and did not discover until months later that no appeal had been filed. Mr. Ryan also swears that his trial counsel did not inform him of the 10-day deadline for appealing, and he swears that he was placed in transit from the moment of his sentencing until June 4, 2009, and that the government denied him access to his legal papers and a law library during that time. The precedents of this and other courts strongly suggest that these facts, if true, would support a two-month delay in the accrual of Mr. Ryan's ineffective assistance claim under Section 2255 F4, particularly given the other facts in the record. As a result, this court should at minimum rule that Mr. Ryan is entitled to an evidentiary hearing on that claim and remand to the district court with instructions to hold one. This ruling would serve the interests of justice and judicial economy. We believe, however, that Mr. Ryan is entitled to the further relief of an outright ruling from this court that his ineffective assistance claim was timely under Section 2255 F4, without the need for further factual development below. Such a ruling is justified by the undisputed facts supporting delay here, namely the district court's commitment of Mr. Ryan to federal custody and its failure to inform him of his 10-day deadline for appealing. Such a ruling also would be consistent with the Sixth Circuit's approach in Granger v. Hurt.
Now, he had two counsel below, didn't he?
Excuse me?
Didn't he have two counsel?
Yes, he did.
At trial, and doesn't one of the counsel indicate that an appeal was not requested?
Yes, Ms. Tejada indicated that an appeal was not requested. However, we believe that that would be a factual issue at an evidentiary hearing, and in addition...
So then why should we grant 2255 relief if there's still a factual issue outstanding?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Ryan also has another attorney, Mr. Kroger, and as the government has pointed...
We haven't heard from Mr. Kroger yet, right?
We have not heard from Mr. Kroger yet. However, whether or not Mr. Ryan requested the appeal is, in fact, a separate issue from whether his claim was timely.
And I have a lot of trouble with that concept of us granting relief when those facts aren't known.
Your Honor, the first point I would make is that this court would be free to grant an evidentiary hearing as relief that would not depend on its making any factual findings about the issues presented here. However, we believe that given that the federal court, district court, committed Mr. Ryan to federal custody and failed to inform him of his 10-day deadline for appealing, that that is sufficient to support a two-month delayed accrual. And, of course, if Mr. Ryan did indeed ask his counsel to file an appeal, that would be even further support for that delay under decisions of this court and the Second Circuit in WIMS. However, this court would not need to reach that issue in order to find that the two-month delay was reasonable and consistent with due diligence. This court would not need to make a factual finding on that issue. It could remand to the district court to make that factual finding, but simply rule that the fact that the defendant was committed to federal custody and that the district court failed to inform him of the time for appealing is sufficient to support a two-month delay and wouldn't have to reach the additional question that goes to the merits. If I could briefly turn to the merits, it is clear that Mr. Ryan has established a decent chance of success on his ineffective assistance claim. Multiple precedents of the Supreme Court and this court establish that counsel's failure to file a requested appeal automatically entitles a defendant to a new appeal. This court's decisions in CAFO v. United States and LaFuente v. United States further indicate that sworn assertions of the type made by Mr. Ryan are sufficiently detailed and specific to establish his entitlement to a hearing on his ineffective assistance claim. Moreover, as we show in our briefs, on multiple occasions, district courts in this circuit have granted evidentiary hearings based on a similar or less robust showing. If there are no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. You may do that. And Ms. Altman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Altman, and I represent the United States in this case. The first issue that must be determined in this case is whether the petition filed in June of 2010 is timely. The government submits it just simply is not. Mr. Ryan claims that it is either under 2255F2 or 2255F4. Based on the facts he alleges in his motion, which are vague, conclusory, and unsupported, his petition was untimely under all subsections and was properly denied by the district court without a hearing. Looking first at F2, F2 gives you a date, a year, to appeal from the date on which the impediment to making a motion created by governmental action in violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States is removed, if the movement was prevented from making a motion by such governmental action. That second clause is important in this analysis. His petition cannot be timely under F2 based on the facts that he alleged. This court has said that affidavits need to be specific, they need to be detailed, and none of Mr. Ryan's allegations regarding F2, regarding F4, or regarding his request to his attorney regarding appeal are detailed or specific. With regard to F2, he provides no facts whatsoever to show how his transit prevented him from filing a 2255 within the year from the date of his conviction, which would ordinarily be the date it was due. transit itself is not an impediment. Otherwise, every single inmate who's sentenced would have that. Every inmate is placed into transit, theoretically, after they are sentenced to get to their home institution. He provides no access, no access to a law library in and of itself is not an impediment. They must show harm. And that's where the lack of facts runs Mr. Ryan into a problem, particularly because in this case, we know he wasn't prevented from making a motion. He filed his untimely appeal in February of 2010, which was before the March due date that he would ordinarily have been required to file his 2255. So based on both the lack of factual allegations and the substance of F2, he doesn't fall under this subsection. Looking at F4, F4 gives you a year from the date on which the facts supporting the claim or claims presented could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. This may be perhaps a closer call, but this exception does not apply either. The facts alleged that would allow the court to determine that he exercised due diligence or not simply are not there. There is nothing about any attempts to contact his attorney. There's nothing to detail why he couldn't contact his attorney other than allegedly being in transit. There's nothing about why he couldn't use a phone or send a letter or contact his parents asking whether or not this appeal had been filed. The lack of facts on its own requires that this contention also fail. Now, even if the motion had been filed on time, it still would have properly had to have been denied without a hearing. Looking at the issue that this court directed us to look at in its certificate of appealability, that is the requesting his attorney to appeal, he makes essentially one allegation on that. And he says, after sentencing, petitioner requested that defense counsel file an appeal. Petitioner was under the impression that counsel was following his wishes. That isn't detailed. That isn't specific. That gives us nothing other than a vague and conclusory statement, which this court has said time and time again is not enough. We don't even know which attorney he spoke to, other than Ms. Jader denied it was her previously. His affidavit certainly doesn't give us any indication about that. We don't know where this conversation occurred. We don't know if it was in the courtroom. We don't know if it was up in the marshal's service after the hearing. We don't know if it was by phone from the jail. All we know is that it was sometime after sentencing. We don't know whether anyone else was present. We don't know if any arrangements were made for payment, which in this case is particularly important because his attorney were retained as opposed to appointed. The bottom line is that his 2255 petition, as I said, and I know I sound like a broken record, but it's really important in this case, doesn't give us any facts. It's vague, it's conclusory, it's not detailed, it's not specific, and based on this, it is properly denied without a hearing, which the district court properly did. And I would ask the court to affirm the district court's decision. Now, should the court believe there is a factual decision or determination that must be resolved in order to make a decision, we would request that it be remanded for an evidentiary hearing as opposed to granting full relief.
Thank you, Ms. Altman. That's a saying that people aren't going to know the meaning of for very long, a broken record.
I know, I was thinking, but I couldn't think of another analogy to give the court. See, these don't break.
We still remember, but the next generation won't.
I'll have to think of something else to use.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Paisner, in reply?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the government's main contention, which is that Mr. Ryan has not made sufficiently detailed and specific allegations to support his claims. First, Mr. Ryan has alleged more than he was placed into transit. He has made specific allegations that he was denied access to his legal materials and a law library. The government asserts that denial of access to a law library does not constitute harm. In Moore v. Battaglia, this court remanded a case very similar to this case where the defendant alleged that he had been denied access to a law library
But here he says that he directed his lawyer, he doesn't say which one, to file a notice of appeal, but there's no indication of any further contact with that lawyer. That wouldn't require a law library or research on his part, just communication with the lawyer.
You're right, Your Honor, but the delayed accrual provision in F2 simply says that if there was an impediment to filing that the government imposed, and here the argument is that there was an impediment to Mr. Ryan making the filing, so it wouldn't depend
on what impediment? Just the transit?
No, Your Honor, it's the refusal to allow him to transfer with his legal materials and the denial of his access to a law library.
Again, he doesn't need that. He can communicate with his lawyer.
That's true, Your Honor.
He's charged the lawyer with filing the notice of appeal.
Yes, Your Honor, and that would go to the merits of the claim, but on the timeliness issue, I don't believe that whether or not he contacted his lawyer is relevant to the F2, the separate timeliness inquiry under F2. I'd like to just turn briefly to the F4 issues, which the government has conceded pose a closer case. I would like to point out that the standard is not maximum diligence. It is reasonable diligence. As the Wims case noted, the Second Circuit's Wims case, even if a defendant could have contacted his attorney, the issue is whether he knew of the need to contact his attorney. And here, the district court did not inform him of the 10-day deadline. That's a fact that was not present in the Wims case or in other cases. And I see that my time has expired.
All right. Thank you
very much.
It has, and we thank you and your firm for accepting appointment in the case and your vigorous advocacy for Mr. Ryan. We'll take that case under advisement and move to the eighth case of